You can see by the slide our names. You can probably discern who's who, but we'll go a little bit deeper than that. So I'm Brett Christie, and I'm Director of Faculty Development at Sonoma State University. Sonoma State is one of our 23 California State University campuses. We're about an hour north of San Francisco. We also have an accessible technology initiative in our state system, coordinator for that effort at our campus. And then I'm a project coordinator and PI for a couple different federal projects that relate to the work of accessibility and universal design for learning. My background's educational technology, further back kinesiology, and that's more than enough about me. A little bit about Kathy, anything do you want to? So Kathy is Director of Academic Technologies at California State University Chico, which is about 3 hours north of San Francisco or an hour and a half north of Sacramento, and then also very involved as the director of our learning management system initiative within the CSU or across the CSU, and has been doing a lot of work in that area, and part of that has been related to accessibility of the different platforms that are out there. We have the you introductions there, but thankfully there's a large number of you, a fairly large number of you, so we're going to kind of roll forward on that. Sometimes we like to get to know small groups, but this is large enough. We're just going to move forward, and through your questions or discussion, we might get to know a little bit about you, because we do want to know what we can in this time. So the goals, we're going to try and develop a very basic understanding of accessibility, not covering much, but enough to sort of set it up. A little bit on universal design for learning, very thin there, and then how that connects to the main, which would be universal design for learning. And I realize we're talking that some of you might be here related to UDL, some might be here related to the Words Online Instruction, some of you may have seen rubric, maybe it's a combination, so we'll be covering all of those. And then talking about the rubric itself, how to apply that, and then how universal design for learning and the rubric came together through our collaborations, and then some of the faculty development efforts and resources that we've developed. Most of these resources are public domain. They're funded by the federal dollars, and I know that also with the rubric for online instruction, they've made that available as well, so we'll be showing you where you can get all of the resources you would want. So a little bit about accessibility. You know, this does come from Section 508 originally as far as our efforts and some of the things we had going on in the CSU. We, you know, unfortunately came to this effort through some negative things, some Office of Civil Rights complaints and lawsuits, and that was in the early 2000s. We then came up with an accessible technology initiative in 2005 as a result. Our ATI, our initiative, has three areas, and one is web accessibility when you're looking at more administrative web pages. The second one, which we'll focus on almost entirely today, is instructional materials accessibility. So the big issue was textbook adoption right away. Sounds simple, timely adoption. It sounds like, you know, you just need to have more forethought and more planning, but that's a very difficult political issue with faculty. Instructional resources themselves, I won't read them all off. You can see them, the different types that we're focusing on, including the learning management system. And then some of the external resources and Web 2.0 applications and things that we're looking at conferences like this where we're trying to really push things forward and advance. And then procurement, which is the third area, which tends to be a pretty black and white issue, but very critical issue in trying to move forward. So in making your curriculum accessible, what we've been doing is we've been really starting with universal design, and that is of the architecture and of our environment, and that's been going on since the early 70s. Much attributed to Ron Mace at North Carolina State. From there, we roll into universal design for learning. We carry over many of the same concepts of architecture access to curriculum access and instructional materials access. And we focus on three areas. How many of you, as far as universal design for learning, feel like you don't know much at all about it? Yeah, you kind of know about it, you've heard about it, or you feel pretty good, knowledgeable about that? If I could quick show of thumbs there. Okay. I think we have a pretty good spread of all three. So what we look at with UDL is we look at three areas for this framework. We look at representation. So as an instructor, what are the many ways that you represent the course content, that material that students need to learn, whether it be through face-to-face lecture, online experiences, you know, a textbook, online materials, etc. So we really look at representation and break that down and have faculty members critically examine their modes. Various forms of student engagement. So how do students engage with you as an instructor, and more importantly, I feel, with each other. Student-to-student engagement is very critical. And then offering various formats of expression. So with students, why would you have every single student do a term paper the same way in the same format? That doesn't work for everybody. If it's a writing competency issue, writing competency course for a program, then I can see. But we ask faculty and we have them ask themselves, why are you doing these things in these different ways? And we examine learning styles and we do surveys of learning styles and we get them to really look at how some of the things they're doing map well and other things really don't map well at all. For example, if a faculty member does a learning style survey on themselves and they find out on a scale of 15 to 75 they're a 16, they really start to think about how they're operating and how a lot of students are going to struggle to connect with their way of delivering a course. Okay, and then we jump into instructional materials, accessibility training, and issues there. I go into a quick visual here on how we're trying to make a major paradigm shift across our campuses. And I know there have been some great sessions here talking about this as well, but sorry, that's a little bit dark on your screen, but we're looking at two different viewpoints here. And one is the traditional viewpoint. When we're talking about students with disabilities, we have tended to talk in the term accommodations, reactive and in a back-end manner. And we have been doing that with our technologies in the past as well, when really on the right, what I would hope you could see well is this universally designed house. Here's just an example of a house that's been universally designed, and as you would be cruising through this neighborhood looking at this house, you would think, wow, that's a great house. Look how beautifully designed that is, how everything flows together. You're not necessarily going to pick up on all of the little things that have been done to help individuals with disabilities have access. You're going to think that's a great house. And that's what we're trying to get people to do, is think about access and openness and flow of their resources and teaching. I don't know if anybody's seen this comic before, and I'll just read it quickly here, but the first caption, student in a wheelchair saying, could you please shovel the ramp? And then the person working there is saying, all these other kids are waiting to use the stairs. When I get through shoveling them off, then I will clear the ramp for you. And the student replies, but if you shovel the ramp, we can all get in. And so simple little ways of thinking about it. And I've seen lots of examples in curriculum and in classes how this happens. And if a faculty member has a student with a disability, they're thinking of two different worlds, and they're trying to teach two classes almost, and they're very frustrated. So we do a lot in working with faculty to think about clearing the path for people with special needs and for all learners. We have kind of a three-level approach as far as what we do with Universal Design for Learning and Accessibility. The framework is representation, engagement, and expression, so we focus on those three areas. Once they're comfortable with that, once they've examined their courses and we've done some faculty learning community exchanges and dialogue, we take them to the next level and we talk about the technologies in Universal Design for Learning and accessibility. And then we take them to the next level, and we don't expect them to become assistive technology experts as individuals, but we want them to know their role at the three levels and how that will enable individuals who need those assistive technologies to get access very quickly and cleanly to the same types of resources. In our CSU efforts, we have failed at the beginning, and we're still struggling because a lot of our efforts with our policy that came out and our efforts in leadership really focused at that red line. And there wasn't this base of understanding and curriculum foundation and universal design for learning. So through this project, we've been able to really build that base and then work up from there. We've seen a lot of other efforts fail because they get too technical too quick and don't understand a lot of the issues. Okay, and as far as how we're doing this, we're doing a lot with faculty learning communities. What we would do, for example, is have a faculty learning community at our, we've had about 12 partner campuses over the last 5 years, and we're going to be doing this at least through 2012, so far funded. And with these faculty learning communities at each campus, there would be a learning community of 5 to 7 faculty members and a facilitator, and we have a protocol that they go through and ways that they will examine their course. So, for example, if we have a meeting next Friday and I'm selected to be the faculty member to present at that meeting, then I'm going to share my course materials ahead of time, my syllabus and a few of the key materials, and then I'm going to present my course and I'm going to present the key objectives, and I'm going to present the key experiences and the resources and the outcomes that I expect from students and how they actually express what they've learned. the group around the table is able to really ask some clarifying questions and then some really probing questions about why things are being done certain ways and what about students coming at it from this angle. And we do it in an interdisciplinary group on purpose because we get some wonderful exchanges from people in English versus people in kinesiology, people in computer science, and even themselves having trouble understanding another faculty member explaining something because they're not from that discipline. So it gets them to really think, okay, I need to do something differently. You know, in thinking about UDL for just a moment, you know, we do get some resistance because people think it's a prescriptive formula that this is how each of you will teach and you're all going to teach the same. But if you know anything about UDL, it's simply a framework with those three areas into which you can examine your course. So it does very little to change your own personal style. What it does is it gets you to improve in those three areas. But you can still have your academic freedom, you can have your personal style. So that's something to make sure you would discuss with faculty. And then in going through this process for the last 5 years, part of our project has also been to capture good examples of some of these course redesign efforts according to accessibility. So through our project, and also in collaboration with a Department of Ed FIPSI project called Elixir, we've been able to develop a large number of video case stories, online video case stories. And these are produced through a platform called Pachyderm. Some of you might be familiar with, a free open source publishing tool. So we've developed those, and now we're looking at probably about 40 to 45 of these developed, and we'll be doing another 10 of these in the near future. They cross, I think, 40 different disciplines as well, so quite a mix there. And then each faculty member is telling their story in regard to coming into this effort, what their goals were, what some of the struggles they saw, and what they wanted to accomplish, and then it goes through the process. Don't worry, each of the clips are very brief, 2 to 3 minute average on those clips. And then they come bundled with all of the resources that the faculty member has developed to actually implement those efforts and those changes that they've made to their curriculum. Okay. We're going to transition from Universal Design for Learning and a little bit of background there to the rubric and online instruction aspects, but questions?
Let me toggle to the website real quick.
As far as time purposes and everything that we're covering, I won't play video clips, but let me go ahead and toggle because I did want to do that to show where some of these are and what they look like and how you can navigate them. So let me show you a couple drill points here. You know, this is our project website where you could find all of those learning modules that I talked about, those online video case stories. If you went to AIM, which is Accessible Instructional Media, or if you clicked on the thumbnail here, you could view those online video case stories. And then if looking at a larger collection, you could go to the Elixir website, and all of these links are in the presentation page already loaded for you, so you don't have to worry about will we do that after the fact, or emailing us, or us emailing you, it's all there. The reason why I show this page is if you are interested in online video case stories related to other topics of faculty development or teaching and learning, then this project Elixir, they've actually developed close to 90 or 100 of these online video case stories now. They'll be doing that for about another year. So you could click and see what the different themes are over here and how they're organized, and then you could go into the different topics. So that URL is also in the presentation page. You know, as far as our state university system initiative and what we have a website there. You know, it's a Chancellor's Office website. It's not the best website, but if you did drill over to resources on the left there and then looked at the professional development website, and this link is in, I think, in the handout, and also it's posted to the page. This is where you could find a lot of the resources that our system has developed to help train faculty and staff regarding Word accessibility, PDF accessibility, web accessibility, Flash, a lot of other advanced things as well, closed captioning. So those are a lot of the things that we've developed. Okay, and let me see if there's, I'm going to go to another page here in just a moment. I'll leave that there for Kathy. So hopefully that helps. As far as showing the videos themselves, I have just a moment here to try one of those. Let me go to the Merlot Elixir website. And let me click on themes and just kind of go through a model scenario of finding these things. Now under themes, I can see the different ways that things are organized. Here's Universal Design for Learning. And then I can see the individual Universal Design for Learning cases. If I can find... Yeah, we won't have audio, and I'm just showing a real quick scenario of how you could find these resources and what they would look like. Although we have closed captioning, so when we have cases where we don't have audio, we fall back on the closed captioning. So here's where you would enter this online video case story, and you would have this phone dial arrangement of all the different resources. Intuitively, you would probably start at the 12 o'clock position, and that's how we've set it up. So this covers the faculty member's experience into, through, and beyond, but also involves the faculty developer at that campus and also involves student commentaries and student evidence and perspectives. And then you could also go to the resources page and find all of the materials that were used and were a result of that effort. So hopefully that helps as far as what the cases are like. So if I click on one of them, we go to a new window within the same case. You haven't left or gone anywhere else. And then I could click play. This one happens to be a pop-up with the new format it plays within, which is even better. And just to make sure we get the other half in, and then we have 10 minutes that we will make available at the end for discussion and questions and all of that on any part of the presentation. So I'll turn it over to Kathy for a little bit.
So first, let's begin with the rubric for online instruction. About 7 years ago, CSU Chico, there were a lot of faculty asking the question, you know, what is good online instruction? And our technology and learning program, who assist faculty in integrating technology, we're seeing faculty who are very humble coming in and having some great stuff, and then some other faculty who are coming in struggling, and while they had some good stuff, maybe because of design or organization or other things, were struggling. So during the summer, we actually pulled together administrators, faculty, and staff and spent several days discussing what is good online instruction. And I'll talk about some of the principles about how we came up with that. But the idea was that we didn't want something that was specific to the technology for what is good online instruction, because we know technology is going to change faster than we can keep up with. But rather, it doesn't matter what learning management system you're using, it doesn't matter what tools you're using, or even perhaps what classroom you're in, smart classroom or not. What is, and give me some guidelines on what is good online instruction. And so we used that rubric for several years, and then of course when the Accessibility Initiative came out in 2005, we then decided it was time to integrate accessibility into the rubric. So at Chico, we've used this rubric now again for 7 years, and we have over 95 institutions in the world that have actually said we are using your rubric. And we highly recommend that people actually take it and make it their own for the culture of your environment. But the key idea is it's mostly voluntary usage, although new faculty coming in, we suggest using the rubric as a beginning framework for, okay, you're going to put a course online. Most of us who have taught a class did not teach it perfect and the best the first time, meaning usually we're developing a course and refining it over a period of time. And so the rubric actually has areas where we start out saying, start out in baseline, don't be over aggressive, then move to effective, and then, if you're interested, move to exemplary. And so what we began doing after using the rubric for a while is a program at Chico State that once a year we ask faculty either to self-nominate, or the people in the technology and learning program who are instructional design folks will actually nominate a faculty member using the rubric and using a form that actually goes through and shows exemplary in each of the categories. And I'll show you what the rubric looks like in a second. And so eventually we got to the point where we have lots of faculty, approximately 30, who have been recognized having exemplary online instruction. And I'll show you some of the pictures that my photographer has actually created where we actually put the faculty into their course content showing where they've been exemplary. And we've adopted this as we, on campus, continue to do large course redesign, asking those faculty to sort of take in the rubric and consider nominating themselves for exemplary online instruction. So here's an example of just one poster. And if you go to Chico State's website where the rubric is located, you'll see many of these posters. And of course, what's interesting is this course was specifically in the American West. So of course, we had her dress up a little bit like a cowboy and in a studio with a blue screen, take her picture and then put the background in. And as you see, some snapshots of the work that she's done. the faculty like as a part of the recognition. Of course, they do put it in their RTP file, but they also like having that hanging in their office, which is great. So the rubric, when we spent time together, we already knew there was a basis for what good teaching is. Good online teaching, of course, follows those same principles. That is, that students are engaged, that there's emphasized time on task, that they get prompt feedback. I know the number one thing that students, at least several years ago when you asked what they liked, it's like, I can always look at my grades. I can immediately get feedback. I don't have to ask my faculty member over and over again, where am I at now? Where am I at now? And that seems to be, you know, more and more taken for granted. But again, we were in that place where faculty spent a lot of time giving feedback to students. And not that that should be not done, but obviously with online instruction, there's all kinds of ways to do that now. And of course, we didn't want to ignore Bloom's taxonomy, obviously ensuring that faculty are aware of that and thinking about that as far as moving students' cognition, you know, further up the scale. The rubric has six categories, the first category being learner support and resources, the second one being instructional design and delivery, the third one being innovative teaching with technology, continuing to move forward and integrating new technologies that students find appealing and engaging. Online organization and design, many of us perhaps are not necessarily, you know, what looks good. And I can say that may seem like a really simple category, but when you have a lot of information, how you organize it makes a big difference in how you present it to the students. Assessment and evaluation of student learning, and then the last one, faculty use of student feedback, not just at the end of the course, but formatively as they're moving through the semester. So again, six categories here. What I'm going to do is flip to, and it's under the Safari, yeah. And actually, we went to a different, oh, it was a different window.
There you go.
And we were under the PDF is this one.
Yeah.
So this is one category, the learner and support resources category. And again, there are six of these, and we put each of them in a different color, so they are differentiated. And the idea is, you know, for learner support and resources, we would say, well, if you're beginning a course, then shoot for baseline. And does your course contain limited information about where the learner can go get support, whether that support is regarding their computer? So for Chico State, we have a student help desk. We have information for disability services available. We have information for the department in case you know, students want to know this course is taught in what department. Provides particular resources regarding the information in the course. So of course, anything from the library or anything from the web which is relevant. Course offers a course content and again, different learning abilities. So that would be baseline, but we would expect that faculty over time as they're developing their course would now look at the effective and then look at the exemplary portion. So again, the rubric has six of those for the faculty to look at. Oh, it's smart enough to know what the next one is. Okay, so this, of course, you can't read all of the specifics, but under category one, you saw that there were three areas there. So if you look at all the categories, here are the different areas that for each of the categories, we have specifics. And so I highly recommend that you go look at the PDF of the rubric and study it. And then again, as we were suggesting, you know, what Chico State chose to emphasize might be a little bit different than the initiatives or the priorities that your campus is looking at. And so integrating that into the rubric so that you're lining up the faculty's course objectives with what it is that your culture is deciding as a priority. Now, this is a very quick snapshot of, if I'm a faculty member and I want to self-nominate, how do I show that I've done exemplary online instruction? And what we do here is we say, well, in words, tell us, for the learner support and resources, what things do you have in your course that are examples and demonstrations of what you've done to create exemplary instruction? And what have you done for online organization and design? So they fill this out, and they actually present it to a committee. The committee then asks those faculty to come for an hour and to demonstrate their course by going through the rubric. And I have to tell you, the faculty who serve on the exemplary online instruction committees say it is the richest teaching and learning experience they've ever had. Because faculty don't usually walk into each other's classrooms and, you know, what are you doing, how are you doing it? And of course, if you do, you get one snapshot of one day. But the discussion that happens when talking about exemplary online instruction, and again, across the disciplines, having maybe some faculty from psychology and education being on the committee, but now a faculty of geography comes in and shares what they're doing for exemplary online instruction, and people want to come back because they really enjoy the richness of that discussion, particularly when they're focused on teaching and learning. So that has been terrific. So then, as I mentioned, as the accessibility came along and the discussion for universal design for learning, CSU Chico chose to create a summer camp. And we focused on, of course, the instructional materials, accessibility, what did that mean, showing some of the tutorials that Brett spoke about earlier that the CSU had actually created. And again, a lot of faculty originally thought, oh God, you're just asking me to do one more thing. But yet when we showed them in Microsoft Word what it took to use styles to make the Word document accessible, you know, some of the hubbub about that all as colleagues talk to one another is it's really not that hard. And as Brett suggested, then you end up with a nice on-ramp because everybody else now has a quick way to be able to go from heading to heading to heading instead of having to scroll, as an example. The summer camp, we talked about, we gave them a presentation about universal design for learning, gave them some worksheets for them to work on, which I'll show you in a minute, and then asked them to think, pair, and share together on where are the areas in their course they might be able to implement better universal design for learning and accessibility. And then we, for the last half of the workshop, it was basically sitting with them to let them ask questions while they were actively working on their syllabus. That was usually the first one where people chose to sit together and actually decide to make that accessible. So that was also very successful. Now, we did a similar thing as far as a form, meaning for universal design for learning, you'll notice across the top you have representation, engagement, and expression. And so we were asking them to, you know, provide opportunities in their course where they might do a better representation of their course materials or have better engagement on a particular topic or express some of their concepts in a different way. And then we put the two together. And I don't think we did it in this screen, but if you can imagine, I have an example from one faculty member here where we were working on representation and they wanted to figure out how to innovate with technology a little bit better. So they went to the area category 5 of innovative teaching with technology. And they went down to C, and it says, a variety of multimedia elements and or learning throughout the course. And they wanted to, under the representation, have more options to provide alternatives for auditory information. So that those who were auditory learners, maybe you got it once in class, but as you all know, we remember 7% of what we heard, but we remember more of what we see. And so they chose to, and I don't remember whether it was create a video or find a video that presented their concept, but that was just one little thing that they added. You know, it took them 15 minutes to say, okay, that's what I want. Of course, they had to take a little time to decide what they wanted out of that, but the minute they put it in their course, now they can say, check, I've just done something for accessibility and I've just done something for exemplary online instruction. So that has been a really successful model at Chico and working with other CSUs. I know San Diego State has also taken in the rubric and done some work in accessibility. So we're working together also. Now, of course, what happens is people say, well, can you give me some practical ideas about how I would take universal design for learning and the rubric and use some instructional technology tools to help me move a step up. So I'm not going to click on these, but you can see that there are links here. And so again, you know, if you're looking at representation and learner support, then do you have web links to the appropriate places? Maybe you want to do a podcast. Maybe within the learning management system, you want to have a learning module that's focused on learner support so that the learner knows exactly where to go in order to get help, depending on what the issue is. So again, we listed different kinds of tools that they could use that will match in that matrix. So this was the closing overall slide. I forget I didn't bring my thing up. So what we wanted to do was, based on what we've presented today, and perhaps you have some good ideas that you'd like to share. I know we best learn from one another. If there's any questions or if people would like to speak more specifically to some of the stuff they're doing, we'd be happy to hear. Anybody? Yes. Okay. Excellent. It did include lunch. Did I mention that? Okay, so I'm the Director of Academic Technology, and I report to the CIO, who reports to the Provost. In addition to that, we have the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching, which is CELT, and we pronounce that KELT. And the KELT Director and myself, and actually my unit and the KELT Director, we meet on a pretty much every other week basis on what can we do to move our initiatives forward. So in the case of accessibility, in case of universal design, we had already had the rubric. So I would say, you know, the provost has both the technology people and the pedagogy instructional faculty development coordinator. And so those, again, we work fairly closely together and do a pretty good job at that at Chico. That's what helped provide picking the people, putting up the agenda, attracting the people who we know were, you know, education, of course, is really good in rubrics. There was somebody in psychology that had a lot of experience building rubrics for their program. So we picked faculty, not that we were closed if others wanted to participate, but lunch and, you know, again, a well-defined agenda. It was great, great discussion. Yes, you had a question. You know, you're the second person who's asked me that question in the last 2 days. I guess I better go look there. I'm familiar with the title, but I'm not familiar in depth. Are you, Brett?
No.
Okay. So it's a good question, and maybe we need a map that would help, you know, line those two up. Yes?
Given the fact that you're looking obviously for assessment, have you ever come across a faculty member or two that just obviously can't adjust to the online instruction?
Actually, not just faculty, but groups of faculty. For instance, in natural sciences, of course, they struggle with DWF, right? D's and withdrawals and F's. And so they felt they were going to use online instruction to try to engage people more. But really, all they did is put lectures online, and that didn't get it. So then we worked with them a little bit more, and eventually, got lucky enough that a woman was then left in charge of it, as in left in charge of it. And she came and worked with the technology and learning program, and we went through the rubric, and they're continuing to now to really get that down to lecturettes and then testing. Did they get that information? Did it make sense? Okay, now we're ready to move on to the next thing. So they're still working at that. And there's another large course redesign happening where, you know, that you make progress sometimes by, you know, drop, and you know, that's the best we can do. Although, again, the exemplary online instruction across the campus, the provost recognizes that, and that is presented, the exemplary online instruction is presented with the teaching award and the scholarship award, scholars award, sorry. And so the provost is recognizing in that awards arena that exemplary online instruction matters. And so every year we're presenting in front of more faculty to get to see the examples and to understand that this is important to the institution.
Thank you. One follow-up question.
Okay.
You know, with online learning obviously exploding, it seems, and more people seeking accreditation, how do you use the rubric, the results of the rubric, to put together some kind of final summary for accreditation?
Just the fact that we had the rubric and that it was being used by 90 institutions, WASC was like, okay, pretty good. I wouldn't say that they drilled down, you know, a lot on that, or specifically, you know, again, as Director of Academic Technology in my area, presenting the work we were doing was to them what I needed to present. As far as the faculty side of things, they may have presented other stuff of how they integrated it, but I feel like I can't answer your question explicitly in what evidence was particularly taken or used from the instructional side. Yes? Love the idea. We are a part of a group called Listen, LCIN. I don't remember what the acronym stands for anymore. But we have used the rubric there, but not specifically had an online community. I really like that idea, and I'll take it back with us and launch. We were going to redo our website because the website is sort of old, especially compared to where we're at now. So we were going to reconstruct the website anyway, and I think the invitation will be to make a rubric community and attach that to the website. I like that. Yes?
You said this was developed specifically for your campus, at least initially. Who are your students? Because you had to have them in mind.
Well, the students who participated in the committee, you're asking?
I'm saying, who is your student population?
We have 17,000 students in Northern California. Of course, we serve the North State. And while Humboldt is in the upper left-hand corner of California, there are the mountains. And so actually, Chico serves the same size as the state of Ohio in Northern California. And then we have many students who actually come from the San Francisco Bay Area or the LA area. Is that what you're looking for, demographics? I'm still not sure.
Percentage of high school class, you know, where they fall in their high school class. Do you have open enrollment? Are you, you know, selective?
Well, we're a public institution, obviously, so access, particularly to California, is really hard right now with furloughs and budget cuts. I'm not sure I can answer specific questions on the demographics you're looking for. Yes? Yes. We do some in-house, but what's the name of that company that CSU has a contract with?
Yeah, there's
do you remember?
Automatic Sync is one that we have a contract with, and what you can do is you can upload the audio file to their site, and it will actually take the video file. It'll make an automated transcription. Obviously, there's an error rate there, but it'll automate that whole process, thread them together, and give you back the file with the line 21 captioning. So you can do that, or if you have the transcript, which is the bulk of the resources or the work, if you have the transcript file, you can upload those two files. It'll seam them together and synchronize those and give you back the resulting file. So we've done that with Automatic Sync, S-Y-N-C, and then we've also been using other free tools like Magpie, which is, you know, pretty low level and takes a lot of time. Or now, what I think is fabulous is with, you know, YouTube has CaptionTube. Many of you may be aware of that. You can caption any of the videos that are out there and add that as an overlay option to the video. And that's a great way for everybody to be able to add captioning as a feature to a video for all sorts of learning enhancements. Does that help? Okay.
Yes and no. We, for online instruction, we did, and I'm sure it's embedded in many of our courses, have Are You Ready to Be an Online Student, where we asked a lot of readiness questions, trying to let the 18 to 21-year-old know that, you know, you can't do 10 minutes when you used to do 50 in a classroom. So we do have a document, but the institution hasn't necessarily tried to force that or, you know, put that in front of the student's face before they get online. So I would say that we're also learning by usually most of the reentry students or the more mature students can discipline themselves, typically, where we do have a lot of students who come from, you know, out of high school to come have their experience learning more about who they are as an individual and struggle for them to understand. For instance, somebody who works for me is teaching a low-level math class, and he's so frustrated because he said the students will not read. You know, they ask an email question, and it was right there on the screen. Now, what we're trying to do is help him put things into smaller chunks because, again, the minute it's a scrolling page, oh, there's a YouTube. Okay, I watched the YouTube. Done. On to the next page. So we are discussing and working through that same challenge. Yes. Yes. Yep. And in Northern California, as you're talking, the last mile, right, for the bandwidth, et cetera, that has been an issue. And you're making me realize I just sort of take it for granted because we've been an online institution for over 30 years. In Northern California, we run into those issues. And continuing education, who's responsible, you know, for the admission enrollment and program development for those students, does insist on particular minimums in the technology, of course. And we were one of the first people to use WIMBA. It was Horizon Live then. And of course, they had multiple bandwidths, and so we had students, you know, at one point using 300 baud modems. And when we switched from WebCT Campus Edition to Vista, we quickly discovered that Vista was not going to allow the 300 or whatever at that point, 2400 baud modem to be used anymore. So yes, it is very, at Chico State, we have a group that every summer determines what are the standards on campus for the student labs, for the minimum of what we want students to have coming in. And we, you know, as all the technology units come together, this is the standard for today. In other words, we've decided to move towards Office 2007, but because we're not refreshing faculty's desktops, the first move was to get them more memory so that we could get Office 2007 on their desks. So there is a good collaborative within Chico State that does talk about the minimum technology requirements to step in. Yes? Matter of fact, just the day before yesterday, we said we think about 25% of our students take at least one online course at being at Chico. And that was a number that wasn't really known. I mean, it was in the data, but nobody had really asked the question. And, you know, so the awareness is picking up, especially as the budget crunch comes down the line. We've had lots of distance ed programs. Well, I say lots. Right now, we're probably five of them that had been established for a very long time. And when we moved from the satellite and a TV broadcast format to the internet, faculty were basically told, with some incentive money, you will make this transition. But now, as new faculty come in and they get assigned distance education, they get told, come to the technology and learning program so we can help you set up. So there isn't any more incentive on that. We have several new programs talking about stepping in. And it's really the departments who are taking ownership, saying, in order to do this, we need faculty who can do this, and then sharing with each other. And we try to help by saying, can we come to your department meetings? What can we help, you know, help you, support you with? What tools can we show you based on what you think? For example, in the beginning, social work told us, we will never do anything online, because social work is about connections with people. What does the internet do? And now they're coming back around and saying, we want to do a master's program, and so we're working with them on going forward. That doesn't have, they might find outside funding, but for right now, it's part of their state job. My area is very broad. Specifically, the technology and learning program, faculty can come into the lab or they can phone in. Our institution is set up that my unit does not focus on standard desktop stuff, you know, printing, operating systems, issues that they have there. The minute they say, I want to integrate technology into the curriculum, that's when they come to our area. So it's very nicely focused in the sense of we're not spending our resources necessarily teaching them Word or PowerPoint or some of the common, you know, things that all people on campus would be learning. And then as far as, I also do run the graphics area and web services and video and photography and distance learning and many other pieces, so that unit is, you know, together to help. I can't say that a lot of faculty take advantage of necessarily, you know, graphics support. But of course, the technology and learning program, being a sister organization to the graphics, understands those principles and so can do a pretty good bridge that way. Video-wise, we haven't made lots of instructional video for faculty, but we will if they can be specific enough about what they're after and make sure that the resources are not hogged too much. Yes? I need to hear a little more about that, meaning are you talking about the fully online programs? As I mentioned, we're already walking into an origination room where they were broadcasting their course, right? And we have students in the classroom, and students that are in their pajamas in their living room happening at the same time. So when we switch to the fully, when you say fully online, is that switch what you're talking about? Or are you saying the institution based on teaching face-to-face, moving to hybrid, moving to online? The latter. The Chico State has the advantage of having had a program with both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree with instructional design students. So we've hired a lot of them. And that has assisted the faculty a lot, those that are willing or interested in coming to the training or walking into the lab in their own time. You know, at first we were resistant to one-on-one because having 1,000 faculty and 3 staff felt a little overwhelming. On the other hand, you know, again, hiring those instructional design students and having faculty come in and brainstorming, you know, it's taken a little time, but we've been strong in this area. We have leveraged our learning management system probably deeper than the average institution. So, you know, I would say even when we moved the learning management system, we chose to do it department by department because the colleagues were then talking to each other about this change that they were going through and then working with each other to say, hey, do you know how to together? And so there were, again, if you can get a department chair or a group of faculty to be discussing, reflecting, analyzing, assessing together what's working and what's not working, that seems to be the most powerful because they spend the most time together. So that might be one area that way. Yeah. We actually have an office, Disabled Student Services, so nicknamed DSS, who actually works very specifically with the faculty and the student. And frankly, we didn't really work much together ever before until the Accessibility Initiative came out and it has drawn us closer. The DSS people are not necessarily highly technology people and vice versa. We may be technology people, but we don't know how to use the technology for disabled students. So that caused a closer connection to happen. I still wouldn't say it's ideal, but I would say that the Disabled Student Services, again, they reach out to the faculty and they work with them specifically, whether it's, you know, tests needing more time or when you talked about textbook adoption, you know, for us, we want the textbook so far in advance because some of them we have to actually scan ourselves. And that's where our DSS department is overwhelmed right now. But the earlier we can get the textbook, the sooner we can get it in. And then the CSU actually has a program together where we're keeping a database of all those textbooks once we've scanned them so we can share with each other across the CSUs. When you say methodologies, we do meet as an instructional materials accessibility group probably on a monthly basis. Where are we at now? How are we informing the faculty? The first year of the accessibility, we said this is the year of the accessible syllabi. The second year, we said this is the year of the accessible PowerPoint. What we're trying to do is move the institution, while anybody could come in at any time and learn accessibility on any of those documents, we are charging people to just take a few minutes to focus on one piece at a time. And if we could keep moving the institution that way, then of course in 7-10 years maybe we'll have you know, a much more thorough accessible set of materials and a better working relationship. Yes. Excellent. You're welcome. So we can go to the EDUCAUSE site and find the blended hybrid. Okay, great. All right, thank you.